Hello, I'm Melon. I'm here to talk to you about quantum computers. I graduated in 2000 with my bachelor's degree in physics and mathematics, and I'm now working full-time as a programmer, getting my master's degree part-time in computer science. So I'm not an expert on this, but I do know enough to understand the articles and the books I've read, and hopefully I can convey some information to you so that you can understand it. First of all, I'm going to tell you how a quantum computer is different from a conventional computer, because that was the first question I had. People kept talking about how cool these quantum computers are, and I'm like, what? They're a computer. And then I'm going to talk to you about the four major types of computers that people are researching right now and the pros and cons that they have, how practical they are, things like that. First off, quantum physics. It's different from the normal physics we see every day. I mean, in quantum physics, you can have one particle in two separate places at the same time, and it's not a contradiction. It is literally both here and there. And we never see that in conventional mechanics. So how can it be true? Well, quantum physics only applies to the relationship between two subatomic or atomic particles, very, very small scale. So we would never see it on the macro scale that we know and love. But in quantum computers, you deal with single electrons, single photons, so you can take advantage of quantum mechanics. One reason that we need to be researching quantum mechanics is because the size of circuitry is getting smaller and smaller every year. It's going to reach a point where you build circuits from the atoms up, and you're going to have quantum effects whether you want it or not. So you may as well take advantage of it. One big effect in quantum mechanics is called superposition, and that is where a particle can be both here and there at the same time. Any absorbable of a particle, such as its location, its speed, its velocity, its magnetic moment, anything like that, it has different states. I mean, the state of location is obviously, where is it? Here, there. The state of its velocity, different speeds. The state of its magnetic moment, up or down. The state of its magnetic moment is a big one, because in the computer world, you have bits on and off. So if you have something like a magnetic moment that's either up or down, you can use that as a piece of information in a computer. We call that a qubit when you're talking about a quantum computer instead of a normal bit when you talk about a regular computer. So if you have superposition, so particle can be both up and down, both on and off at the same time, then every time you perform an operation on that bit, you're doing it to both values at once. This means that you can process much quicker than you could on a normal computer. If you have 8 bits on a normal computer, there's a possible range of values from 0 to 255. Normally, if you want to perform an operation on that range of values, say to test if they're prime, you have to do it on one after the other, and there's a certain amount of time that it takes. If this was a quantum computer, you could represent all of those values simultaneously, perform one operation, and get the value, the result for each of those values. Now, the mathematics involved to translate the answer you get to something you can read is horrendous. I mean, that's where a lot of the research is trying to figure out these answers you get. Because, I mean, you have a bunch of bits that are both on and off. How do you know which answer applies to which question, kind of thing. So superposition is a great tool. That's the big plus to quantum computers. That's what makes them go so much faster than conventional computers. But it also leads to a problem. Well, it doesn't lead to a problem, but there's a downside to it. It's called decoherence. All right, there are several words that have the word coherent in them, that are vaguely related but not quite. You have coherent light, which is like a laser light. All the particles are in step with one another. They're all pointing in the same direction, the same kind of particles. And then you have incoherent light, which is normal light from the sun. All the particles are, they don't care about each other. They're going all different directions. They're all in superposition states, too. They're all both waving this way and waving that way. They're crazy particles. When a particle experiences decoherence, it goes from a superposition state to a normal state that we can observe. And you can see how this would be bad if you had a quantum computer processing. It had all this information in a superposition state, and then it experiences decoherence, and you lose most of your information. Very bad. The problem is decoherence happens all the time. We cannot observe anything in a superposition state directly. We just can't comprehend it. I mean, how can you comprehend a particle in two separate places? How can you... We kind of impose our view of things onto the quantum world, and we make it more simple. So decoherence is a big problem, and it happens very frequently. It happens any time you measure a particle. We really have never seen something in a superposition state. We've only seen its effects, which is a good way to prove that it's still valid, but it makes it hard to watch a computer, a quantum computer, while it's processing. You cannot keep track of what it's doing because you'll lose all your information, whereas with a conventional computer, you can make sure everything's still going fine, not losing any information. You can't do it with a quantum computer. You turn it on and you pray. That's it. Another way that decoherence happens is a result of entanglement. Entanglement is another quantum effect where two separate particles influence each other. You get two particles together and you entangle them, and then you take them far apart and you do something to this one. You make it flip, and then this one will also flip, even though you didn't do anything to it. You can make a lot of technology out of this, and it has both good and bad effects in the quantum computing world. Its bad effect is that if you get two particles entangled, and then one happens to go into your quantum computer and the other one is outside, and it experiences decoherence, the one in your quantum computer will as well. Bad. But then it's good because entanglement allows us to do some error checking in quantum computers. Imagine you have 8 bits. Say you're only using 5 of them for actual processing, and the other 3 you're using for error checking. They're entangled with some of the other 5. And you can check the ones they're entangled with to see if they've experienced decoherence, and then you know if you have a problem in your quantum computer. So it can be both good and bad. And entanglement happens very easily. I mean, particles are like teenagers in love. You get them together and whoa, they're entangled and they want to stay together forever. Yes? Sorry? We don't know if there's a practical range. There's a lot of experiments being done right now at the Los Alamos labs. They're getting particles further and further apart to see. Because theoretically, we know of no range, but practically speaking, there may be, because we have to keep the particles in storage and transport them, and that's where the problem is. It's hard to keep a particle in a very delicate superposition state between here and there.
Is there a lifetime delay? Wait. We are recording.
We're trying to record this for posterity, so any questions in here as soon as we get this working. Just look at it this way. We'll make you famous.
Okay. So try to remember your questions, I guess. So I was talking about entanglement. It happens very easily. And one of the other things you can do with entanglement is communication. I mean, think of it, if you had someone you wanted to communicate with very secretly, there's no way you can eavesdrop on entangled particles. There's no connection between them. So that would be a great way to communicate very secretly. But then you would have the difficulty of transport of the particles. Okay, I guess now I would ask if anyone has any questions just about physics in general.
He came over, so I wasn't sure if you answered this part. I was wondering what was the practical range of entanglement, which you sort of answered. I'm not sure if that got on. And the other question is there any sort of time delay?
Between entanglement? Entanglement is instantaneous. The two particles will experience their entangled effects immediately, simultaneously. And the range experiments are being done right now within a dozen kilometers or so to make sure that, yeah, they want to be able to, I mean, think of one of the big problems with space exploration is the time delay in communication. So if you were able to communicate with someone on the moon instantaneously, that would be a huge bonus.
That was what I was trying to lead to as soon as you mentioned entanglement. I hadn't heard of that as a possible zero time communication, but cool.
Does this lead to any causality problems, this faster-than-light communication?
It's not, I mean, because the particles themselves are not moving faster than light, you don't have any relativity things happening before they happen sort of problems. Yeah. There's another question.
Can entanglement happen between more than two particles? Can you have three-way entanglement?
You could have a particle entangled with a particle that's entangled with a particle and have it happen that way. I'm sure there are many different combinations of entangled particles that I can't even imagine.
In order for an entanglement to occur, don't you often have to have the particles in a closed system together for a given amount of time?
Yeah, to have controlled entanglement occur, to know that they're entangled and that these two specific particles are. It happens in everyday, not in everyday life, but in atomic particle life all the time, but we have no control over it. We don't know which particles are doing what. But for a controlled environment, yes.
So in order to create a distant quantum computer with control, you're going to have to do that artificially, in effect.
Yes. You're going to have to bring the particles together, entangle them, and then separate them. And the separation process, keeping them stable, is the difficult part.
Do we know enough about the entanglement process to yet begin to understand the distance?
They think they do.
Okay.
Okay. Now I'm going to talk about different kinds of quantum computers, how they take advantage or how decoherence entanglement is a problem for each of them. There are four major types that people are studying. Some are more practical than others. The first one I'm going to talk about is called an ion trap. Okay. Take some electrodes and make a potential well of electromagnetism. So if you have a charged particle in there, it'll get caught. Then take a metal and heat it to about 800 degrees Celsius so it vaporizes. Then shoot a laser at it so it strips some electrons and makes it ionized. And then they are trapped in your little electrode well. And then hope that you only have one in there, and if you don't, you're going to have to figure out how to get the others out. And then the little ion doesn't want to stay in there because it's been shoved around a lot, so it's vibrating intensely. So it'd be very difficult to aim a laser at it or anything like that. So you have to laser cool it, which is where you, it takes advantage of the Doppler effect, which I don't know, maybe you know about this, maybe you don't. If something is moving towards you that's emitting wave pulses, say a train, when it's coming towards you, the pulses happen more frequently from your perspective because it's emitting at a regular beat, but then it's moving towards you at the same time, so the waves are closer together. In a train, then the pitch would sound higher, or a plane, attacking you or something. And then as it leaves, it, the opposite happens, and the wave pulses are further apart, and the pitch sounds lower. You have the same effect with light. If something's moving away from you, it'll be red-shifted, and it'll look like it's really further away than it is, and if it's moving towards you, it'll be blue-shifted. Astronomers use this a lot to figure out how a galaxy is spinning. They'll look at one side and measure the red shift, and look at the other side and measure the blue shift, and figure out how fast it's turning. Now, if you do this with a laser to a particle, what you want to do is only hit the particle with the laser when it's moving towards you. That way you're stopping it. Ions have a little happy frequency where they will absorb an electron, and that'll kind of, it's like catching a football or something, it'll slow you down. So you tune the laser to its happy frequency but shifted towards you so that it'll only be absorbed. Anyway, so you laser cool it. And then you have it in your little ion trap, and it's reasonably cool. And its zero and one state is not excited or excited. And you excite it by hitting it with its happy frequency laser. And then you make superposition states of excited and not excited at the same time, which is not sort of excited, even though it may seem like it. It's not that it's in the middle excited. It is both happy and sad at the same time. Okay. With a computer, you have something called the switching time, the time it takes to kind of do a process, to switch a bit on or off. And then you have, in quantum computers, their decoherence time, the amount of time you expect to have before the particle is no longer useful as a quantum bit. And you kind of compare the two, the switching time with the decoherence time, and it lets you know how much time you have to do anything. So the switching time of an ion trap versus the decoherence time is actually pretty good. You can get 100,000 processes done, maybe. But the amount of labor involved in trapping an ion may not be practical. I'm not sure we've actually trapped an ion long enough to do anything to it. Most of the good experiments have been done with other technology. So that's an ion trap. Another one is called cavity quantum electrodynamics. This one is interesting to me because the bit, instead of being an electron or an ion as it was in the ion trap, it's a photon. This is interesting because a photon does not interact with other photons. So how do you get the bits to do, you know, if this bit is on, then do something to that bit, because they don't care about each other. What they do is in their little cavity, they have an ion, and the photon will interact with the ion, which will interact with another photon. So it has kind of an intermediary. And the cavity in cavity quantum electrodynamics is a very small box type thing that is kind of set to the standing wave frequency of the photons, much like an organ pipe is set to the standing wave frequency of air. That's how you make the sounds. This will make the photon resonate inside the little box and make it stay there longer, have more chance to interact with the ion. This has very, very fast switching time because they have photons and go very, very fast. But their decoherence time is slightly larger. They end up with having about the same usability as the ion trap, but it's kind of hard to keep track of photons because they go so fast. So, and plus the setup, I mean, because photons go so fast, you have to have such a large area, you know, because you can't really have any equipment fast enough to keep track of a photon in a small area. You have to have a large area. Therefore, to have more than, say, half a dozen of these bits, you'd have to be huge. Like, the mainframes of old age have nothing compared to this kind of processor. Like, cover the Earth, then maybe you'll get 100, kind of, I don't know. So cavity quantum electrodynamics is kind of fun for the researchers and the people who like to play, but it's probably not very practical. One of the most practical ones, and the one that the most experiments have been done on, is nuclear magnetic resonance technology. This is the same that's used for MRI machines that you see in the medical world. You go in there and they do strange things to you, and then they have a map of your body. This happens because the molecules inside us all have a small magnetic field, and you can twist and turn them and using a large magnet, and then you can see how they're twisted and turned. You can see where the molecules are of specific types inside your body. The way they use this with a quantum computer is, say, you have a molecule that has two atoms in it. One atom has a specific magnetic moment, and the other one has another one. That's its little magnetic field, just like the Earth has. And you put it in a large magnet, and it makes it line up. You know, just like you put iron filings on the paper, and it makes them line up in a certain way. Well, you set it so it makes the particle line up one way. So you have one atom going this way, and its little magnetic field is here. And then the other atom of the molecule is sticking out here. And then the next time you send a magnetic pulse through it, depending which way it's aligned, this way or that way, it'll spin this way or spin the other way, kind of thing. And then it sends out small pulses, and you can see which way it's lined up. It sounds really complicated, but because so much research has been done in the medical field on this, we already have a lot of the background knowledge we need and the background technology we need. And the big bonus to nuclear magnetic resonance technology, NMR, is that with the ion traps and the cavity thing, you only have one particle. And if you lose it, you're screwed. With the nuclear magnetic, you can actually have several particles. You have like a little vial of liquid, whatever liquid you're dealing with. So you have kind of a built-in buffer. Like if some particles decohere, it's okay. If some particles are not paying attention to you, it's okay, because you have a backup plan. Kind of like a normal computer, you have a stream of electrons in a normal computer. And if some of them get lost, you don't really care. But you would care in an ion trap machine. In the nuclear magnetic resonance machine, you kind of have the same safety in numbers kind of effect. But these have an extremely slow switching time. Like a millisecond switching time, because you have to power up a magnet and adjust the frequency it's at and wait for all the particles, all the molecules in the liquid to do their thing. Very slow. But because of the safety in numbers, it has extremely long decoherence time. You can keep it going for like a minute. Yeah. And the number of these you can have, the way you have multiple qubits in, say, an ion trap is you have multiple electrons. The way you have multiple qubits in an NMR machine is not to have multiple molecules, because that's your safety in numbers thing. They're all identical. It's to have multiple atoms in one molecule, and then the different effects of the different atoms' magnetic moment. But then this is limited, because if you have a very large molecule, say 50 atoms or something, so you have 50 bits, it gets much harder to tell the atoms apart. They don't influence each other as much, because to them, it's the opposite side of the world, basically, the opposite side of the molecule, because it's so huge. So this technology is limited in the number of bits you can have. So you can keep it going for a long time, so do a lot of processing, but on less information. The last technology I'm going to talk about is the quantum dot. This is kind of a fun thing. It's superconductor technology, semiconductor technology. It's like the face of a die, you know, like the five on a piece of dice. It has little pits in it where an electron can stay. And you put two of these next to each other, if there's an electron in one, it'll influence an electron in the other, and you can actually make a circuit, like a normal circuit, out of these things. And this is kind of a developing technology to make circuits out of quantum dots, and it sounds very promising, but the ratio between the switching time and the decoherence time is extremely short because you have imperfection in the little quantum dot, and in the normal quantum dot technology that they're doing, not for quantum computers, just for really, really small conventional computers, you would have a stream of electrons moving as you would in a conventional computer. But for a quantum computer, you'd only have one. And due to the imperfections in the building of the quantum dots, it could escape. So your decoherence time is extremely short. So even though this is more familiar technology to us because we can build normal circuits, and because we can have lots and lots of these things, because you just make more of them, their usability is kind of short. Okay, that's about my question. Yeah, any questions on the four types of computers?
Do you think that advances in the NMR technology will allow development with the other three computers?
Will what?
Do you think that with advancing in the NMR, that it'll help advancement in the other three types?
I don't think so, because most of the problems in the other three types are their technologies, the methods they use to be a quantum computer. So it'd be kind of hard for it to overflow and benefit those as well. I mean, the work they do on just thinking of new quantum algorithms would branch over, but not in making them usable.
I was wondering if there were any significant heat problems with any of the four processes.
Well, there definitely is with the ion trap one, what with all the lasers and stuff. But I don't think there really is that I know of. I mean, with the NMR, if there was a heat problem, then you'd have big problems with MRI machines that you put people in.
Right.
With the cavity one, it mainly involves, I mean, I suppose it's possible, but I haven't heard of any giant meltdown problems kind of
right.
thing.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
It sounds like a lot of this is pretty theoretical at this point. Do they have any idea when or if this might possibly become reality?
Well, they have done a few successful experiments, mainly with the NMR technology, with, say, 5 bits, and they've done some processing and gotten answers. But as far as large scale, I mean, it takes time, it takes funding. It can happen eventually if the theory is sound enough and the technologies have enough potential to do something, if people will do it. Let me think if I have something else to say. Of course, there are benefits in cryptology. The main benefit being if you have, like, normal RSA technology now is based on large prime numbers. If you have a processor that can find large prime numbers quickly, you can find even bigger prime numbers. But then you can also use the same processor to factor a number that is the multiple of two primes very quickly, or quicker than you could now. Now it's not really feasible, but it could be feasible with a quantum computer, not only because it's faster and because it does processes on multiple numbers at a time, but you can also make up whole new algorithms using a quantum computer, taking advantage of the quantum effects. And that's where a lot of the research is being done now, because you don't have to really get funding for that. You just have to have a bunch of physicists sit around and think. Oh, one other neat thing. The other neat thing about the cavity one with the photons is they recently found well, they've done some recent experiments with Bose-Einstein spaces or objects. That's it, condensation, where you basically can freeze particles. It's not really freezing them, but you make them very still where they would normally be very fast. So if you're worried about transporting, say, two particles that are entangled and putting them far apart, you could do that if they were in a Bose-Einstein condensation. And I think it normally affects photons, so that's why it's good for the cavity one. Any other questions? You can even ask questions I can't answer. That's okay. Here's one.
What areas in the States or outside in colleges are they looking at this?
There's a big one in England. If you go to qubit.org, you see their website, and it's huge. They're doing a lot of research there. Not too sure which specific school it is. It's just in England. I know it's in England because they spell center with an R-E. And Los Alamos Labs are doing a lot of it. I know in Maryland they're doing a lot of theoretical work. I don't know how much experimental work they're doing. I don't know where else. I have a website set up, which is not very useful. It's basically just this rambling that I'm doing, but typed down. And it's on atlanticon.org. You can find it from the AtlantaCon site. And from that page, I have links to the Los Alamos Labs and the Qubit people, some of the books I've read and some of the articles I've read in Scientific America, that kind of thing. So if you wanted to do some of your own research, that's a good place to start.
Thank you.
Questions?
Is there any book for the layman that you would recommend, like sort of a brief history of time about quantum computing?
Well, the book I started with was Minds, Machine, and the Multiverse by Julian Brown. And it's kind of a combination layman and physicist book. It was right when he was starting to get going good with the physicist part, he would switch to layman mode, and he'd explain it in kind of simpler terms. I'm like, no, I wanted more. But if you don't want more, if you don't want the hideous math and stuff like that, it's a good place to start. Julian Brown. And then a book I just bought about a month ago, but I haven't had time to read because someone lent me Final Fantasy VII, and that's all I've been doing, was Quantum Information. I can't remember the author, but I have a link to it from the AtlantaCon site, so you can find it there. And that looks like an excellent book, so I can't wait to read it.
What do you see as the final use of this type of computer?
Its main use will be in doing multiple processes on it, like anything that you want to do often, repeated again and again, or that you want to do on a lot of stuff at once, a quantum computer will be good for. Think of whatever technology, whatever applications you can. As far as, say, a desktop computer, because of its storage issues, the fact that you can't read information directly, it really would not be useful as a conventional computer is widely useful today. It would more be the heavy-duty processors.
With the way that the particles are working, as far as you could have one over here and one over here doing the exact same thing, mm-hmm. wouldn't there be a security issue in the fact that if they produced a computer, they could produce a duplicate computer, store it somewhere, and then have whatever you do with it?
That could be a problem. In making two duplicate computers, and then if you had the information stored on them already and then someone managed to make a copy. But the process of entangling the particles with the particles you already have set up and then entangling them with some others, it would probably be very filled with errors kind of thing.
It would require a constant update kind of system, similar to, I don't know,
will say Microsoft, then wouldn't it be possible to keep updates on a constant basis? I mean, if you have to get your computer updated every 2 weeks or whatever, then you're getting the exact same particles back, and it's going to be doing the exact same thing. I could sit in my office somewhere and know exactly what your computer is doing.
If you were doing the kind of thing that a quantum computer would be useful for, the massive repeated processing, you would not be updating it frequently because you wouldn't want to start from scratch frequently. It's kind of the start it, don't interrupt, stop kind of thing. And then you have the answer. It's not, you wouldn't be able to interrupt the ongoing processing because you would destroy your information. So someone could start from the same place you are and then probably finish in the same place, but if they know your starting information already, it's kind of a lost cause.
Also, unentangling them is about as easy as entangling them. If just to unentangle particles, all you have to do is give them a value. They're unentangled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just by the with the communication thing, that's one of the problems with the communication, because you get the value from it once, and they're unentangled now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to do it one particle at a time, sending them out. So it would be, I mean, all you would have to do is judge them once, and boom, they're unentangled. So you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Any other questions? One here.
Is anything besides the quality of the particle altered? In entangled particles, if you alter one, is anything besides a quality of the particle transferred to the other particle? I mean, there's no kinetic transfer or anything like that. It just changes states or
right. You don't. The particles themselves don't physically move. There's no. It's just the state the particle's in, basically. Which, if you're talking about energy, could possibly transfer energy. But I'm not sure if they've done any experiments to see the results of that. But there's no physical transfer between the two. It's just like the information that they're holding kind of thing.
You also mentioned that by merit of us measuring or observing a given particle, we can alter its state. That's fascinating. I mean, what's the mechanism for something like that? Is it human mind, human will? I mean, what?
Well, trying to think of a way to say this that's not an equation. I mean, we ourselves are not in a superposition state. We are in very basic collapse state. So unless we are simultaneously both here and there, how can we see a particle that is both here and there? So by looking at it, it has to be in one place or the other for us to see it, kind of thing. I don't know how to explain it. Quantum physics is extremely weird. One of like the prerequisites for being a quantum physicist is the willingness to be weird, admit you don't know what's going on, and believe the unbelievable. And usually be kind of a science fiction fantasy freak, because if you're going to think about multiple dimensions and timelines going on at once, it really helps to... yeah. Well, there.
Could you give us an example of what some of the differences in the algorithms that you have to go through for quantum versus regular?
Not really. I have a book on that. I have a book on quantum algorithms, but I haven't read very much into it, even though it's a very skinny book. It is very dense and purple. But I really don't know much about the different algorithms they're thinking of yet. I know that there are some very fundamental, like Shor's algorithm, which was basically what prompted all the funding that's going on right now. In 94, Shore at Bell Labs thought of this algorithm to figure, I forget if it was factoring or finding primes differently than we do now, using a quantum computer. And that's what prompted all the funding to actually make quantum computers and see if you can actually do this. It all started in 94. No more questions? Okay. That's all.